Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wortman, and I'm here with my co-hosts Lara Chambaker and Bianca Bremen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the finely manicured koi pond that is our recording studio and dissect three different links that we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we kick off our sixth season. Amazing. Today is our 73rd episode, and we're going through our open tabs, and we'll be discussing working for free, designing for the end of a studio's life, and of course, as we do, Kanye. As we also do once a month, we're going to our virtual sweat lodge to astrally project ourselves to New York, where we are joined by North American managing agent and producer Bianca Bremen. Bianca, welcome back. Have we missed any major life events since we last spoke?
Wow.
Anything you want to share with the listeners?
Well, regular listeners may recall that we kicked off our last season, season 5, with Lara, you making some personal predictions for Jeremy and myself for the year ahead. Do you want to tell us what your personal prediction for me was?
My personal prediction for you was that by the end of this year, you would be engaged. And Bianca, would you like to share the update with everybody?
Well, I am running ahead of schedule here, as you two know already. And Lara, you're a bloody prophet. I am thrilled to announce that I am indeed engaged, which is incredibly exciting. So shout out to my fiancé Dave, who rarely listens, but said he might if I mentioned him. So
What up,
basic Dave? We were so happy for you, but also I'm really mad because you got engaged in Aruba and the entire office, and now my partner, my housemates, my family have had Aruba,
Jamaica.
Ooh, I want to take it. Stuck in our heads for weeks now. So
Lara, do you recall what your prediction for Jeremy was? I didn't go back and listen to the episode.
It was very boring. It was that he would have a full VR set up in his home by the end of the year, which I still think is probably going to happen.
Yeah.
Boring.
How are you guys?
You've already done all the life milestones, Jeremy.
Well, congratulations to you, Bianca. We're also happy. And if we weren't such strong proponents for copyright, we would definitely get some Beyonce happening here as a backdrop. Already concerned about Lara's Beach Boys potential violation there.
Come at me.
We'll just see how we go. Anyway, we're all back. We're getting things kicked off. So Lara, get us started. Take us into the new season with your link.
Yeah, I thought we should talk about Kanye just to kick things off, because isn't that the way all good seasons start? I sent you guys a few links this week from Medium, Hollywood Reporter, a few other things. So there's a lot of stuff out there at the moment on this. There's something that's sort of rocking the music world, pun very much intended. So basically back in January, Kanye West launched several lawsuits against his longtime record label, Rockefeller Records and Def Jam, and as well another one against his music publisher EMI. And it's sort of all been in this bid to invalidate his existing contracts with these companies. And it's the EMI lawsuit that's been making news again these last couple of weeks. So at the time, the lawsuit was heavily redacted and we didn't have a lot of information. But last week, well, it's probably a couple of weeks ago by the time this episode airs, but last week all the details from the suit were made public, and it is a sticky one. There are a ton of articles flying around about this, and a lot of them just sort of pull the legal jargon straight from the lawsuit documents, and it took me a lot of reading and Googling to figure it all out. So today I just wanted to try and make the situation and each side's legal arguments a bit clearer for you guys. So as we now know, Kanye's original suit from January is an attempt to, quote, obtain his freedom from the contract. And he cites this California labor code that basically limits personal service contracts to no more than 7 years. Given that he signed the contract in 2003, that's 2019, Jesus, his attorneys are arguing that this period should have ended way back in 2010, meaning that in their eyes, for more than 8 years, EMI has enforced these rights in total violation of California law. And Kanye's seeking not only the ability to sign new deals with other record labels and publishers, but also his lawsuit alleges that EMI has been, you know, unjustly enriched by millions of dollars. And he's seeking the rights to all works he published after October 2010. So that includes albums like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy and Yeezus. And it's massive. Okay, so that's Kanye's side. Now, in the other corner of the ring, we can see that EMI might have seen this argument coming from way back when, because they actually included a bit of a safety net for themselves in the original contract wording. So they actually included a disclaimer that the contract only requires Kanye to deliver his ownership interest in the songs he writes, but for purposes of California law, these deals don't constitute contracts for any of West's personal services. And as we now know, the California Labor Code that Kanye's team are using as the crux of their case relates strictly to personal services. So EMI are saying that because of this little extra clause they included, it's actually not an argument over personal services or employment. It's actually about intellectual property rights. And because Kanye is not only seeking to get out of the contract, but also to regain all of the rights over his works, EMI were then able to move the suit to federal court. And that's important because federal court has full jurisdiction over copyright law. And contrary to the California Code, under federal law, authors must wait 35 years after the date of publication to reclaim their rights. Of course, Kanye won't want to wait that long. And so we're going to see some pretty serious counter-arguments, I think, here as things progress. And it's here that things get really tricky. So yes, EMI has this clause in there, but Kanye's lawyers argue that the fact that they included this safety net clause at all really just reflects EMI's awareness that their contract was violating that California public policy. And a lot of the argument seems to be coming down to one key stipulation in the contract, which requires that Kanye, and I quote, remain actively involved in writing, recording, and producing compositions and major label albums as his principal occupation, going on to state that at no time during the term will West seek to retire as a songwriter, recording artist, or producer, or take any extended hiatus during which he is not actively pursuing his musical career in the same basic manner as he has pursued such career to date. Or in layman's terms, and why Jeremy's laughing, it means he's not allowed to retire. And a big part of the argument from Kanye's team is that a contract provision forbidding retirement is, quote, comically inconsistent with any notion that West Steel doesn't constitute one for his personal services. So as the complaint states, EMI would have had no interest in ensuring that Mr. West continue to write, record, and produce songs and continue to actively pursue his music career unless it was party to a contract with Mr. West that required him to render personal songwriting, recording, and producing services. So EMI saying that it's not about personal services is a little nuts. And then a couple of days ago, like a week and a half ago by the time this airs, EMI executed the second part of its plan to sort of keep their grips on Kanye by hitting him with a breach of contract lawsuit in New York. And in EMI's newest complaint, they contend that the publishing deal also contains a clause providing exclusive jurisdiction in New York, as well as a clause that any controversy will be adjudicated under New York law, which is, again, just them trying to move things away from that California Labor Code. And this new countersuit brings up a whole lot of questions about jurisdictions and what can and can't be determined by a contract. Kanye is likely to argue that parties can't contract around California's laws restricting contractual servitude. And because EMI is essentially suing Kanye West for suing EMI, that might provoke an argument that the publishers are attempting to crush Kanye's First Amendment rights to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So we can probably expect what's called an anti-slap motion, which is basically a motion to dismiss retaliatory lawsuits that are brought in an effort to intimidate and silence opponents. So imagine Kanye's team are going to argue that that's what's happening here. And what I'm saying is it's going to be messy. There's likely to be a range of suits and motions filed before anything really happens. But overall, it is a huge case. It could have massive impacts on the music industry and significantly alter how publishers and record companies engage their songwriters and performing artists. That California Labor Code that I keep bringing up is one that's often used by actors and musicians to get out of their contracts. And it's so potentially damaging to record labels and publishers that they routinely include language, just like we've talked about here, that specifically states their agreements can't be construed as personal services contracts under California law. So some even go further, like demanding that the songwriter or artist warrant not only that they don't live in California, but that they don't intend to move there in the future. It's like pretty full on. But yeah, that said, while disputes over personal contracts are pretty common, this question of IP rarely comes up. The argument's usually over whether the contract remains in effect, not whether the company continues to own the artist's creative product. Artists are typically seeking only to get out of the deal. While the company, you know, might be forced to release them from the contract, the company would still keep the copyrights to things published during the term of the contract. That seven-year rule, as we know, it governs personal services, but not copyright ownership. And what's significant here and so potentially impactful about Kanye's lawsuit is that he's using the rule as a way to try and force the return of his copyrights. Ownership of those rights is so vital to publishers and labels. Like, that's how they make their money, by exploiting those rights. And the value in those rights is in part, of course, tied to that lengthy duration of copyright under some laws. So if the seven-year rule can negate that, then it's a huge shift that could pose quite an existential threat to music publishers moving forward. And it's the only the beginning of the fight, but a win here would be a pretty incredible victory for songwriters and performing artists, and pretty catastrophic for music publishers and recording companies. Now, of course, this is music industry. We don't work in the music industry, but anything copyright is of huge interest to us and relevance. And I wanted to chat to you guys. I mean, obviously, none of us are lawyers. None of us have read all of the case documents, not even me. We wouldn't probably be able to understand them if we did. But just on a personal level, what do you think about all of this? Do you think that Kanye and other artists should be able to get out of their contracts after a period of time? Jeremy.
Oh my God. I mean, yes, again, huge preface. None of us are lawyers, like, in the slightest. I mean, this is all, we're all just.
But I don't want to know the, like, what should actually happen in this case. But in general, what do you feel about this stuff?
Yeah, I feel a bit conflicted here because I think, you know, contracts are so rarely done to kind of, like, it's such an imperfect science. Like, you have kind of two people at both ends, like, all kind of fighting for their best interests, and the contract kind of sometimes, ideally, should represent kind of a meeting of those interests kind of in that way.
But that's pretty rare, isn't it?
It is pretty rare. I mean, there's always a compromise made where kind of you just kind of need to kind of give up on something in kind of that way. And I kind of feel that all of these kind of, all these contract disputes are always things that were done, like, that were kind of done at a long time ago, and then all of a sudden kind of something happens, and then that kind of changed circumstances, and now they kind of want to change it. Or,
oh yeah, you know, something- I mean, like, I think Kanye signed this agreement in 2003 and then released College Dropout in 2004, so this would have been like the start of his career.
Mm-hmm. But this is what also makes our job kind of so difficult as agents when we're dealing with contracts, is that, like, yeah, like, I think, you know, we're not doing our jobs if we're not predicting. It's like, I know it's overly optimistic to think that every job we do is going to be amazingly successful and could go on. But the fact is, you don't know who's going to be hugely successful and who's not. And so it's like, you're always kind of balancing kind of these risks out, and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to use contracts as a way to kind of mitigate those risks and give everyone kind of certain assurances and things. So it is kind of really confusing.
Because it's the thing, it's like, many clients won't agree to engage an artist if that artist doesn't agree to certain things in the contract, right? But and them taking that job or not taking that job could be the difference between them kind of blowing up or not blowing up. But then it's like, if they do blow up, but it's under this horrible contract, what have we done for them there? And so it's a really tricky thing.
I mean, every contract does need to, like, every contract is underpinning a business relationship, and I think is always acknowledging that both parties are kind of taking risk and contributing something, and both people want to get something out of it. They want to kind of exploit the agreement in some ways. And it's impossible. Like, I think that's one of the biggest challenges of legal work, is finding that middle ground of how to craft a contract that actually looks after both interests. And I know in all my experience dealing with contracts, yeah, like, one, sometimes I'll look at changes that our lawyers make, I'm like, this is crazy. Like, this is, you know, this is more than we need, or kind of, you know, or too much, and be like, but that's what we pay our lawyers to do. And I think,
I always see in contracts for, like, creative stuff, it's like, and there'll be like a clause, it's like, in case of, I can't remember the actual legal word, but in case of war, or like, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, why do we? But those things happen, and you need to have a document you can refer back to.
There's the other clause that's like about media. Like, they talk about, you know, like, digital devices, and then devices, or like ways of transmitting media that have not even been invented yet.
But that's so pertinent in today's age. Like, these things are popping up, you know, faster than we can write contracts. So, I mean, I want to know, like, Bianca, again, this is not about what should actually happen in the court in this case, but on a gut level, there's one thing about letting him out of his contract, right? Which I personally feel like, to contractually require someone to be a musician for the rest of their lives or whatever, or for however long, is, I think if someone needs to get out of that, they should be able to. But in terms of the rights to the music that was produced during his time with EMI, how do you feel about that? Do you think he should have those rights reverted back to him?
My fellow Gemini, Mr. Kanye West. I mean, I hope he doesn't retire, and I hope he keeps making music, because I know he's had a very problematic and controversial year, but I don't know. Ye was probably one of my favorite albums of 2018. So I do still think that he has some music in him that I would like to listen to. I've always found, like, music contracts very, very difficult to understand, because they're probably similar to like an agreement that you would enter as an author. It doesn't make sense for me for someone to own the rights, like, to your work if they're the ones that are investing. Like, I understand that a record label is investing in an artist and they're putting up a huge advance to create a record, and then they're using their position to leverage that and exploit it and make money from it for everyone, and everyone gets a cut of the money. But I feel like there should be a term. And I did actually ask a friend that works in music who said that like a lot of agreements like have say like a 10-year term and then it reverts back to the artist and or the label can get out of it if they wanted to drop the artist. But then the, you know, the first rights revert back to the label has first rights to negotiate any new work after something's been terminated. I think it just it's weird to me that like someone who is like say Kanye West, who's being Kanye West, doesn't have ownership of their music. So I feel like
because a lot of these clauses came from extensions and amendments that happened not in 2003 but in later sort of periods. And to me it seems maybe at the start of his career he agreed to certain things, but to later not have been more protected seems kind of crazy to me. I mean, on that, like I want to know from both of you, what lessons do you think we can learn from cases like this, especially with regard to anyone signing contracts with publishers, labels, representatives of any sort?
Well, I just wanted to touch on quickly, like, I mean, we're waiting on an album from Kanye, which he was supposed to release like months before this, I think these negotiations happened. So I wonder, is he just trying to get out of releasing that? Like, I don't even know.
Or trying to get the full rights to the release of that.
Yeah. Look, I think, you know, one of the big takeaways here that I try to keep in mind is that many times contracts are really kind of just suggestions. There are so many things in contracts that are really unenforceable in a lot of ways. Like I learned this myself, like, you know, when, you know, trying to create employment contracts, for example, and you know, what is reasonable, what is not. Like sometimes.
Just wait till you see what I do to you, Jerry.
It's really kind of setting the kind of just the spirit of the agreement. And I kind of think, you know, arguments like this are really interesting because so many times people don't have the money to fight it. And a lot of with copyright law doesn't actually is, you know, a lot of copyright law is kind of suggestion. And I kind of think that I think the law itself is always kind of meant to be tested. One of the biggest problems here is, though, that the amount of money it takes, it really kind of disadvantages smaller kind of creatives. So it's like, I think it's great that Kanye is kind of raising this issue and kind of potentially, you know, making it something that could kind of change law.
Because precedent plays such a huge role in this, right? So if he could get a ruling in his favor, that would help smaller artists in that there would be a legal precedent set.
But I want to bring that up because there was a Taylor Swift actually got out of her, I think she successfully got out of her recording agreement towards the end of last year. And she actually now does own the copyright on the recording of any music she makes from now on, I think. But I guess
it all depends on the languaging and the differences.
I think it is really great that these big landmark cases are happening, but I wonder actually how much kind of overflow there really is to smaller independent artists or artists that, yeah, you know, are sort of like 18, 19, 20 at the start of their career or perhaps even younger. And yeah, I wonder about that.
Well, we'll see, I guess, over time.
Yeah, look, I think kind of to end it as well, it's like, you know, you see the kind of law being misused when it comes to IP really in kind of recent years, especially with patent trolls. I don't like, we could do a whole episode on patent trolls. Basically, you know, people that use the law of the patent to kind of just shake down kind of other people who are doing kind of completely unrelated things. And I kind of think, I don't want to get too DNM.
Save it for next week.
Yeah, I don't want to get too DNM here, but like, you know.
Jeremy says every single episode.
Okay, episode title locked in. But a lot of this is a reflection of kind of a capitalist society and system as well, in terms of like where everyone is, you know, fighting after their kind of own self-interest and, you know, trying to get the most kind of growth possible. And I think, yeah, with people trying to get out of their contracts as well, it is sometimes a reflection of, yeah, this imbalance of power that I think inherently exists in kind of creative relationships. And I think by bringing these things up, by having these conversations, that's kind of really valid. But also we talk about this all the time. It's if you're an independent freelancer, if you're running your own small business, you are kind of all the different areas of your business and you have to be kind of your own lawyer in that way. And I think one thing that we've seen come up that I want, especially want to draw attention to in this episode is things like with NDAs, like things that sometimes look deceptively simple. We've seen NDAs kind of coming through now that are signing over IP rights basically before you even kind of sign the NDA. And I think, yeah, the tricky thing you're signing over IP rights before you actually kind of start the job, just by signing the NDA before you actually
Even know what the brief is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Before you kind of formally engage.
Read your NDAs, people.
And I think this is the problem because, you know, the whole aspect of like contracts and the law has, because we're having to cater for all these different things, it becomes a very complex, time consuming and expensive thing. So people are less willing to have more nuanced conversations about what the spirit of an agreement kind of actually is. And I hopefully, you know, I'm seeing that kind of change in kind of really kind of small ways. But yeah, I think it's, you know, things like this, even though it kind of seems a bit superficial and kind of tied up in celebrity, I think it does kind of affect all of us kind of in our own way. So yeah, hopefully this can be a great prompt for everyone to educate themselves a bit more on what they're actually kind of getting into when they're kind of signing contracts. So Lara, thank you very much for bringing that up. And
you're
I think
welcome.
We'll move on from there. Okay, it is my turn. And look, it's a bit bittersweet to talk about this link because, look, on one hand, it's about the wrapping up of a really exciting and vital studio, Haraf. Bitter because one of the co-founders, Carly Ayers, was a previous guest on this very podcast and also someone we've had a long-term connection with things like Creative Mornings. And I guess, look, to see anything kind of come to an end, no matter how kind of how short or how long, but especially a studio that's taken such an amazingly unique approach to their practice, it's always a bit of a sad thing. The link itself that I'm talking about this week is actually their newsletter from the studio that announced they're kind of shutting down. And this was their final newsletter.
And their only newsletter.
And their only newsletter. But that's where the sweet part kind of comes in. Because in announcing their folding, they kind of gathered together literally all of their internal and working documents, scrubbing out sensitive info, client details, etc. And they put it all out there in a huge kind of data dump for the entire world to dig into. So just to get you up to speed, if you haven't listened to our previous episode, you're not familiar with Haraf, and they're a studio. How dare you, indeed. Haraf, H-A-W-R-A-F. Do you remember, what did Carly say it stood for?
Something about ants wearing red argyle.
I don't think anyone knows what it stands for. I think
they make it up every time.
Yeah. So, but they established themselves in 2016, which I can swear it was longer than that, but it is actually quite recent. And the partners are all former staff from Google's Creative Lab. And I'm quoting here from an article in Fast Company I'll be talking about later, but they aim to transform the design studio model by being more transparent and doing ambitious, engaging design work that push the boundaries of how people interact online. So this final statement from them could be considered their greatest piece of design yet, I think. And it's just an absolutely staggering gesture of generosity in so many ways. So if you haven't had the chance to jump into the Google Drive where all these socks live, I really urge you to do so while you still can. You can also download the entire thing, which I did personally, as there's way too much to read in kind of one sitting, and I don't want more open tabs. How they managed to do this in terms of the transparency they must have had between each other as well as their clients is really what blew me away. Like, this must have been a real, you know, labor of love and effort to actually do that. They literally put out their P&L docs for all their finances, and to get four people to actually agree this and then actually do it, I think it's a real testament to the unity and trust they established with each other as a studio, which is amazing. I mean, not just two people, four of them. So, you know, that's a lot of moving parts to consider. So I think this document in particular also answers some of the biggest questions that I think lots of cynics would have as well, just looking at this news. And it's easy to think that any business kind of closing is closing because they weren't successful or they weren't making enough money. But, you know, this actually clears this up because you can look through all their kind of documents and it's clear this wasn't the case. If anything, they were actually kind of prospering and doing well. So one of the earlier outfits to write this up was my beloved, beloved Fast Company. Catherine Schwab, a writer, got some great sound bites from some of the founders, including partner Andrew Herzog. And he uses a boat metaphor to explain what happened. I'm quoting.
You love a good metaphor.
Love a good metaphor. He says that the team devoted the first year and a half of the studio's existence to figuring out how to run the business or make the boat float. Then we started getting projects that we thought we could do and were good for money and started to make sense. We started getting paid adequately, he says. The boat started moving and it became time for everyone to start paddling the boat. That's where we looked up to the first time in a while and realized that maybe we had different ambitions in terms of the business, where it could go now that we knew how to make it float. Look, apart from sharing their actual documents from pitches, processes, contracts, the newsletter also does a great overview of the work they did as a studio, as well as kind of what each of them want to do together moving forward as individuals. So look, I really can't say enough good things about this entire thing. They dissolved in the same spirit that they started. And the fact that they took the opportunity to be honest with themselves, the members of the design community and the clients is really inspiring because none of this stuff exists in a vacuum anymore. Everything that a studio does, like not just kind of their work, but how they operate and kind of who they are as individuals, like that's under the microscope in so many ways in this current landscape. So for me, it asked some really deep questions. And I think some of this came up while we were talking to Timba the other week about the article about failure and endings of studios or projects. And my hope is that acts like this will kickstart some bigger conversations about how we talk about and deal with things as big as death in both a personal and business sense. And as I said before, failure like death can be a really taboo topic, but I think so many of the problems we face today from the design perspective is that people never consider death or the endings when they consider what they're kind of starting or making. It's always so easy to make things and spin things up, but it's harder to sustain them and harder to think about where they're supposed to be going. And I think in other industries, like product design, for example, is happening much more. Obviously, there's environmental things to consider when you're doing things like making things physical. There's an amazing book that I always love recommending about this called Cradle to Cradle. So it's about kind of a design process that doesn't talk about cradle to grave, but actually about kind of renewable kind of making and actually kind of this cradle to cradle model. But if anything, I hope this actually forces more traditional studios like design or, you know, creative studios to actually think about what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what the plan for succession actually is. It obviously takes a special group of people and a special studio to do it in the way that Carly and her partners do it. But I think that's sometimes what our industry needs in terms of one radical act being done to give other people the inspiration that they might be able to do it themselves, so that is something that they can do. But yeah, I think this kind of thinking, while sometimes can seem morbid on a superficial level, can actually have a really profound impact on how you deal with business and personal matters on a day-to-day level, especially in the current creative climate where everyone wants to work to have that kind of meeting. In many ways, what Hara have done here is kind of had their own living wake. They've done things on their terms. The studio died and in its will left us, the creative community, with their entire estate. Now they get to do what dead people don't often get to do, though, or, you know, who knows, but they get to hear all the good things that people, you know, say about them and see how the fruits of their labor can actually kind of benefit others through what they're kind of leaving behind here. So it's, yeah, really, really awesome. So look, to that end, I wanted to open it up for a bit more discussion. B, let's go to some practical matters for a moment. I mean, you know, we talked about this actually just this morning, but starting the New York office in scratch in some ways was like establishing your own startup, and you personally had to develop lots of new skills and tools as part of this process. So going through the documents and kind of everything they put together, I'm curious, what stood out to you most? And is there a particular bit of info somewhere that you think would have been useful for us or you in this way? How can you see what they've shared here as being benefit to other creatives?
Oh my God, there's just so much, isn't there? I mean, like as tiny as, you know, like the IKEA shopping list for when they first moved into their studio and like their lease. But I mean, there were some fascinating things like their, like a business plan, a financing pitch, their marketing decks, which are incredible, profit sharing calendar, their actual expenses from the past 3 years, a list of every single project that they've ever charged for. There's just so, so much. And I spent a good bit of time just kind of like digging through. But Jeremy, you're right. I mean, moving from our headquarters in Melbourne to New York to open up our North American office. Back in 2006, funnily enough, same time, I did kind of have the opportunity to go through the process of starting up something, although I'm not totally on my own because I have a wonderful mentor in yourself, Hyde, helping me figure it out. But that being said, like the nitty gritty of and the ins and outs of setting up and running a business are incredibly foreign to me, not to mention that I'm the fact that I'm literally trying to do it in a foreign country. So I appreciate 100% so much Horaf's generosity here. And I think that a lot of artists, whether you're an individual or someone starting up your own studio, or whether you're an established artist, I think it would be, or design studio, I think it would be really incredible to kind of like have a dig around here and you know, have some conversations around some of the stuff that Carly and the team have shared. I mean, in terms of kind of like how things relate to us, maybe to give like a little bit of context. I mean, when I was working in Melbourne, I was, you know, I oversaw our production team, which I guess came with its own sort of growth and learnings. But here in New York, my responsibilities definitely have expanded to include more of like a general management role. And you know, I do oversee some more of the day-to-day operations of the business here in North America and have like more transparency over our financials. And, you know, I'm directly responsible for developing our office culture here in New York, which is something that I really love and is something that is really exciting. And but you know, like all the kind of like other general management stuff, you know, at times has made me feel a little bit like I'm swimming in the deep end. Like a lot of creative people, I studied design. I have absolutely no formal business training, and I'm going to assume that most creatives, whether they're an individual artist or someone wanting to start their own studio, and Jeremy, you mentioned it before when we were talking about contracts, that yeah, when you are a freelance artist or freelance designer or whatever it is, like you are wearing a lot of hats and you are trying to do everything. You're your own account manager, your own project manager, all of those sorts of things. So it is like incredibly fascinating to get a look inside how someone else has done things. And I guess like from a purely voyeuristic perspective, and honestly, like massive props to Carly and the team for putting this stuff out there. I kind of would feel quite vulnerable putting this kind of information out into the world, but it was, you know, it was super fascinating just to even simply to get like a glimpse into their wish list of dream clients and why, you know, maybe they wanted to kind of work with certain people. And of course, to like dig into some of the financial docs, like the Every Project We Ever Charge For spreadsheet, which, you know, lists the client type and size, the deliverables, the budget, and the duration. And I think it was interesting to see that for a lot of projects, well, not for a lot, but for a very small handful of projects, they did, you know, with their clients do part payments in trades, like whether it was a painting or a case of beer or something bigger like furniture or an overseas trip. You know, no one in the creative industry is ever transparent about what they charge for their work. So I imagine that these financial documents are going to be what a lot of people digging around this folder are going to gravitate towards first. No, I was just going to go back to your original question about whether there was anything particular that may have been helpful for us. You know, Jeremy, you and I kind of like, we're chatting a little bit about some of the frustrations and challenges of setting up a business, especially in America earlier today. But, you know, our businesses are very different. And we also, I think, in terms of how it relates to us, like we weren't starting something new from scratch necessarily. It's more so we were really building and expanding on something that we already had, just in a new market, which I guess brings its own new challenges. And I think my answer would be a little bit different if I was actually starting something of my own. But, you know, a lot of the biggest challenges and frustrations that I've experienced that, you know, I've actually had conversations and asked, like, I remember when I was trying to figure out health insurance just for myself, I actually reached out to Carly and was like, hey, you guys have a very small studio. Like, how do you deal with health insurance? Because it was more like that kind of stuff, like the understanding tax and accounting here in the US and dealing with the sheer amount of paperwork and bureaucracy that America loves to throw at you. I mean, that kind of stuff isn't really covered in these documents, but everything else, oh my God, it's just like being able to see how someone else has kind of like set up and structured their business and how they're communicating with their clients, like the kind of like feedback and questionnaires that they're sending. One thing I particularly loved was really seeing how much time the partners spent defining their core values and their negotiables and non-negotiables. I think that is a true testament to who they are and how they were actually able to kind of like have that trust to share this stuff with the world. I think all of that stuff is like super fascinating. And yeah, I just like loved going around and poking around and absorbing it all in.
Be really interesting. Laura, I want to pass it over to you. I mean, I want to get your overall opinion, but also kind of a bit more specifically, I mean, after launching Corvid and really having a deeper look and understanding on some of the things that happen behind the scenes to keep a business going, I'm curious on your perspective here. It seems like impossible for us or a business like us or anyone else to ever do something like this. I know Sagmeister, you know, Stefan Sagmeister, before they partnered, I haven't seen their site in a while, but you know, they had that kind of webcam set up like on their kind of ceiling.
Okay. I was like, oh, just, like watch the office.
Yeah, you could just watch. And I think, you know, I love this idea of kind of transparency, like I've thought, but it's impossible for us to do. And I think so much kind of social change, like, you know, comes like around that. It's like, you know, some people think things are kind of really hard, like, oh, recycling is kind of so hard, or I can't kind of do this thing, but then, you know, builds up this kind of critical mass. So look, I'm just kind of curious, like, I think there may be some areas that businesses could be more transparent with that would make for a healthy industry as a whole. I mean, what do you think that could kind of look like?
Yeah, I mean, you guys said it all, really. In their short time, Horaf lived up to their values in a way that I honestly haven't seen any other agency do ever. For me, the thing that really gets me about this collection of documents, as well as all the other sort of bits and pieces that they've put together over time, not just it's in here, the various articles and stuff they did, in the name of transparency and skill sharing, essentially, you know, donations to the creative community. It's just the incredible amount of time it must have taken to do all of that, and what a wonderful sacrifice that is. And I don't doubt that there are many of us out there, ourselves included, who would love to contribute so much to the community, but actually carving out the time to do it, and also the incredible sort of humility and vulnerability and generosity it takes to share the inner workings of your practice with everyone for free is just enormous and really impressive and rare. And I think, you know, the fact that they can see beyond their own personal gain and be so seriously open about specifics of how they do everything from pricing to legal agreements, to business strategies, so on. I mean, like, we've talked a lot on this show about transparent companies, but it's just a whole other level here. Even just like the legal services they would have had to engage to actually go through with something like this. It's awesome. And they deserve a huge thank you and congratulations. And I really can't wait to see what they all do next, even if I am sad that the band is breaking up. Your question, it's a tricky one because, like I said, there's a huge amount of vulnerability involved in doing something like this. Transparency, it's great, sure, but you have to acknowledge that in the wrong hands, this info could be used against you in your business, especially when it comes to pricing. Given that we're in a value-based pricing model as well, there's a whole lot of context, I think, that's missing when you look at some of these documents in particular when it comes to pricing. When the business is closing anyway, there's very little risk. But for a business that's still operating, you don't really want to share all of the ingredients of your secret sauce so that others can put you out of business. You know, and I think COVID is actually kind of a good example of how we've tried to take transparency and help the community, but in a way that doesn't risk, you know, totally destroying us, I think, because the way that we price and manage projects and clients is our secret sauce. You know, it's like, that's what we bring to the table as producers. So giving that away for free isn't feasible. At least I don't feel it is. Maybe that's just, again, that barrier that I'm putting up. But I think, you know, through COVID, we are able to find a way to help artists that need this information, but also be compensated for our time and our worth and control the message in some way. And I also think it is about giving this information out in a responsible way. Like Horav are very clear in their documentation. They've got all these like disclaimers that all of the stuff that you can see in there is just the way that they've done it, that there is a lack of context and everything here is specific to them. But I think undoubtedly people will just take the info and run with it in some cases. And I like that with doing one-on-one consultations through something like COVID, we can make sure that the information we give to someone is specific to their situation, because that context is so important. But overall, I think, you know, revealing all of this stuff when the business is closing is a brilliant idea, like just absolutely tremendous. And I would love to see that happen more. If that could be built into the sort of exit of more companies, that would be phenomenal.
Yeah, it's yeah. And again, like, you know, there is kind of, you could take a more negative view of it and look at it that, you know, is a brilliant marketing tactic for all of
them
as well.
Why is that negative?
If that's what your only kind of view is.
Yeah, but this is the thing. This has come up before, like where people do amazing stuff, you know, taking their time to do things for the community. And there's got to be something in it. Well, it doesn't have to be something in it for them, but if there's something in it for them, I'm happy. Like, that's great. The fact that it's a great marketing opportunity for them means that they were able to sort of carve out the time to do it. And that's nothing to be negative about. Good on them.
Good on them indeed. Truly wise words. Thanks everyone for your feedback. And yeah, we'll post a link as we do every week so you can see for yourself on our show notes. And we will move on from here. Bianca, over to you as we round out the episode. What is your link for the week?
My link for the week. Let me just bring it up. Okay, so I guess continuing on a bit on the theme of finance, my link is brought to us by the AIGA, or the American Institute of Graphic Arts, and their magazine, Eye on Design. And it's a first in a new series from them called Design and Money, which aims to tackle issues about fair compensation for the creative community. So I guess they're trying to open up a little bit of discussion about transparency around pricing and things like that. And this first article, it kicks off with an interview with design legend and Pentagram partner Paula Scher on why and when it's worth it to work for free. And regular listeners of the show will know that champion for creatives and making sure that artists are being fed and creatives are being compensated fairly for their time and value is a huge deal for us here at Jackie Winter. So I thought it would be fun to throw an argument that slightly counters the obvious into the mix. For many creatives, the case against working for free may seem like a no-brainer, but Paula argues that it is not black and white. Her position is this: does she ever work for free? Of course she works for free. How else could you have total creative control over a project? As always, we'll post a link to the article in our show notes so that you can read the full argument. But according to Paula, working for free offers an opportunity to grow your work where you have control, which will ultimately lead you to do better as a designer down the track. She says agencies understand this and they do a huge amount of pro bono work. I find myself competing with them for theaters or public organizations because they want the piece so they can show it to get other work. They set it up to get control of the work just like I do. That's right, doing work for free is a total power move. And the article goes on to debunk some of the common misconceptions about free work. But before we unpack some of that, I thought it might be good to pause here and get some initial reactions from you both. What do you reckon? Do you agree? Is doing work for free a power move? Jeremy, maybe we'll start with you.
Can I just explain a bit more, like, why, how does Paula explain it as a power move?
because she's putting the control, like she's setting it up so that she's in control to do the work in a way that works for her, and the client will be getting whatever it is that she wants to give them.
This is so tricky. I mean, you know, we talk about kind of privilege on the show a lot, and like, you know, surely like this is going to kind of come out to be, you know, a really kind of thorny issue. I mean, look, I appreciate for her for taking a bit of a controversial stance here. And it's something that we grapple with like all the time as well. And like, I think with all of these really complex topics, it always comes back to intention. Like even when talking about kind of, you know, things like contracts, like, you know, what is the intention of the contract? What's the intention of these two people coming together? And when it comes for remuneration of work, it's like, what is the intention there as well? And I kind of think that, yeah, it depends who's making the ask. Like, you know, what is the ask? And like, what are these, you know, all these things? You know, what are all the kind of pieces of the puzzle that are being put together here? And again, if we go back to, you know, the whole idea of capitalism being kind of challenged at the moment, like I think this gets to some really kind of core questions of kind of how we value our time, how we value our creativity, and how we value our work. And I think that there definitely was a period, you know, where I think things were a lot more black and white, you know, and I think we definitely have huge opinions on kind of how, on where kind of value comes in, like, you know, with things that we're going to be launching, you know, about licensing and kind of things like that, especially, and kind of, and all these things. And yeah, things like the no spec movement, for example, about doing work on spec was, you know, a huge part of that as well. But I think it's just, there's so much of a gray area now. And I kind of think there is the voices that are kind of really, there's actually a Facebook group called Stop Working for Free that I'm part of. And some of the stuff I read there is so difficult. And I think, you know, a lot of this came up when we were talking about Artslog as well, you know, that blog about kind of like, yeah, where, you know, where is this kind of line? So I'm going to kind of, I don't want to kind of, you know, have a cop out here. I can take the easy way out of these kind of arguments, but I want to come back to it. But my general kind of opinion is that there is room for lots of different kind of discussions to kind of be, you know, to be held kind of in the same time. And it does, lots of different things kind of matter. There is no kind of one answer. It is okay to work for free under certain circumstances, I think.
Yeah, I agree. This is such a dense topic. We have covered it a bit on the show before, but Paula Scher's comments are a pretty interesting addition to the conversation. I think there is some real truth and value in her statements. And Jeremy, as you said, there's also a lot of privilege. I do agree in some senses that yes, if you're working for free, it should come from a position of power, not as a victim. But I think a lot of what she says comes from the beneficial place of being experienced enough and in demand enough that she can turn these pro bono requests into a powerful opportunity for herself in a way that might not be feasible for others. I think, like, there's so much to unpack here and we don't have time for all of it. So I wanted to focus on the main things that struck me in this article. There's a part where the article says, working for free does not imply you don't get anything in exchange. In fact, if forgoing a paycheck means you take total creative control, it's just the opposite. That's why pro bono work is great, says Scher. You choose to do it. And if you're choosing to do it to grow your own work, your deal is essentially that you're not going to collaborate. You're going to do the job the way you think the job is going to be done, and they're going to use it. You start by setting the expectations, which can vary widely. If the client expects a lot of back and forth and revisions for free, for a paltry fee or otherwise, you set the rules and can allow for as much or as little of this as you like. When Scher is confronted with a good-looking opportunity with some not-so-great-looking strings attached, she just says no. I say, I don't want the fee. I want to do what I want. You have a choice. Now, this to me is all well and good. Great. If you can take creative control over a project and use it to explore something totally new for yourself and generate a great folio piece that you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise, and you don't necessarily need the money, then yes, working for free in some of these cases is a totally fine idea. However, I think, like, I just kept thinking to myself when I was reading this, how many clients have we ever come across that are genuinely willing to let a creative do entirely what they want without any input from their end? Like, seriously, like, I think this is where it's important to be Paula. Like, she has such a wonderful reputation and a very well-earned and deserved one at that. And that means that clients might be willing to trust her to do her thing. But for anyone not in that position, taking on free work often does mean a lot of back and forth and not complete control over the creative. Does that mean you shouldn't do it if you're not Paula? No, not necessarily, but there are a lot of things to be considered here on a very case-by-case basis that she's left out. And I think the other point I really want to make is that when it comes to charity work, she talks about having total creative control. Like, and I just think it's not just about an opportunity to do whatever you want. Like, the whole point of working with, and this is specifically with charities, right? I'm not speaking to other sort of types of free work, but you know, it's important that the final piece of creative actually works for that charity and does the thing that they need it to do. Like, that charity is getting this artwork because they need to leverage that to, I don't know, make more money or whatever it is, raise awareness. And to, I don't know, I think without the opportunity for revisions of feedback, that can be hugely limited. And I think if you're taking on a pro bono project for a true charity, not just someone not willing to pay who can't afford it, but a real charity whose money's going towards charitable causes, then it's important to accept that you're going to need to work with them to get the creative right. Like, obviously, you still set expectations, of course, around the number of revisions or whatever, like you would with any client. But to take complete creative control and to not allow them any input, I think is actually kind of arrogant and selfish when you think about the purpose of the work. And I mean, that's just a very personal feeling for me. But I think, you know, if you're not willing to do that, maybe don't take on pro bono charity work. Like, I think if you want to explore a new style or have total creative control over something, make real time for personal work. Like, you can do that with your own personal work. It doesn't have to be with a client. And I guess, yeah, the thing I get stuck on again and again is the duty to yourself versus the duty to your industry and where those things overlap. Like, what duty do artists have to their industry and to themselves to take a hard line on not working for free, but also, you know, to themselves to open their opportunities and to not say no to income or whatever it might be, right? And I agree that there are cases where working for free is absolutely okay. And that's a very personal, individual thing for each artist. But I also know that there's a lot of damage that can be done by artists who slash their prices out of desperation. And again, I understand why they do that and where that desperation comes from. So it's a really tough issue.
Yeah, it is really tough because I think the nature of commercial art and one of the most satisfying things it is this kind of exchange. You know, mm-hmm. It's not this thing that's kind of done in a vacuum. And I think that also working for free and volunteering and being of service is a really important part of being human and being mm-hmm. a creative. I think it's really kind of enriching. But yeah, like, you know, it's when we're putting it in a work sphere where it is a sphere of kind of commerce, it gets so much kind of stickier.
Yeah, she didn't actually talk a lot. I would have liked to hear her talk more specifically about the sorts of clients that she's comfortable with working for free and not working when it's not okay. She didn't really talk that much about when it's not okay to work for free. And I'd really love to hear like where the line is for her.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think as well, like, it is important. It's, you know, sometimes working for free doesn't mean working for nothing. It's like, well, yes. And I think, you know, that whole idea needs to be kind of expanded more. And I think this idea, just as we were talking about contracts, that there needs to be room for kind of more nuance. There needs to be more room for actually how creative projects are commissioned. And I think, you know, we're starting to see it a bit, like in terms of especially how design companies will design for equity. So, you know, and obviously, Paula is putting a huge value on her creative development in terms of that she is getting to develop kind of unfetteredly in this way, but that might not be a value kind of different person. I think that's the whole idea of value in general. It's so relative.
Yes.
So there are no
absolutely.
Kind of, it's really hard to put kind of a universal kind of theme around it. But I think as we're kind of dealing with how we talk about kind of money and how we deal with talking about compensation, these conversations are going to get more frequent and more relevant.
What I do definitely agree with and what I appreciate from her is that she talks about how, like, whenever just the sentence work for free like comes up, designers, illustrators, everyone just like freaks the fuck out. Like, everyone's up in arms and like people are really like, because a lot of young designers are told never work for free, you know? And so it's like, it's hard to make space for these kinds of conversations about when is it okay? And I appreciate that she is trying to open that up.
Yeah, it's a messaging thing as well, though. I mean, again, I keep thinking, you know, it always takes back to politics, but it's like, you know, you look at kind of the movement towards kind of socialism in the States as well, but as socialism is such a tainted word in so many ways, it's blocking, you know, things from kind of happening. So it's like, yeah, obviously.
Rebrand.
You know, yeah, maybe working for free needs a bit of a rebrand. Maybe Paula can do that for free. Exactly. And just to reiterate, like, I have nothing but immense respect and admiration for Paula and her work. And I'm so glad that AIGA is doing kind of this series as well. So B, thanks very much for bringing to the table some great stuff in there. As we round up the episode, it's time for our favorite segment, the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, the totally righteous off of our chest. Why? Because that's just what we have been doing, and we're going to continue doing it. So, Laurie, get us started. What do you got? Thumbs up, thumbs down, Shaka?
I have a... God, this could be any of the three, to be honest, but I'll make it a thumbs up. This is my favorite thing this week. The MIT Technology Review recently published a story. It was titled "The Hipster Effect: Why Anti-Conformists Always End Up Looking the Same." And there was a photo accompanying the article. And the article is basically a summary of a research paper that found that in trying to make a countercultural statement, hipsters often end up looking just like each other. And there was this sort of treated photo at the top of the article. And basically, MIT, they sort of tweeted all about this. They received an angry email from a man who was really unhappy when he saw himself being used as the lead illustration for the article, and he was accusing the Technology Review of slandering him. And basically, the editor-in-chief of Technology Review, Gideon Litchfield, he tweeted about this saying, "Now, as far as I know, calling someone a hipster isn't slander, no matter how much they may hate it. Still, we would never use a picture without the proper license or model release. It was a stock photo from Getty Images, so we checked the license." And they found that the photo did have a restriction stating that any use in an unflattering way must be accompanied by a note stating that the subject is a model. And he tweeted again, "We weren't implying that the model had an STD, only that he was a hipster. We didn't think that this met the definition of unflattering or unduly controversial. Still, we recognize that others might disagree. So just to be on the safe side, we contacted Getty." And Getty checked the model release and gave them the news that the guy who complained was not the guy in the picture. All of which just kind of proves that hipsters look so much alike that they can't even tell themselves apart from each other. It is just a beautiful full circle story that made me very, very happy this week.
B, what do you got?
I don't know if mine's like a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Mine's just like I've been spending a lot of time in my dermatologist's office recently, and I was just reminded of this because I just saw a tweet that had...
Sounds so New York. I feel like all New Yorkers have therapists and dermatologists.
I've been three times, and I meant to ask this morning when I was there, but they have a video, like they have a television screen playing behind the counter, and it's just Bob Ross, you know, the 70s, like it's just video Hell clips yeah. of Bob Ross every single time. Why?
Happy little trees.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, we should have that going on the office screen.
It's stressful being at the doctor. You know, Bob Ross kind of takes it down a little. It's fantastic.
Maybe. I don't know.
What about you, Jeremy?
I've got a massive thumbs down for this. Is like, I think, you know, me and you always talk about, you know, this thing is like Australia. This thing is like America. They're different in this way. We could do a whole podcast on that, actually. But I think one of the biggest ones that I cannot stand is the fact that there are no restrooms in Australian service stations, like 7-Elevens. And
they used to be.
I know there used to be, but it's like, it's. I just think it's a crazy, like it's just so crazy to me. I think, like, if anything, like is... And look, the one
maybe they do have them, but you're asking for a restroom and they don't know what you mean.
Okay, I'll cop to that. Sometimes I have to put it in different ways. Deal with loo, a WC, a bathroom, whatever you want to kind of call it. But yeah, it's like I just think it's such a sad destruction of the commons. Like, all there should be public restrooms in all service stations. And like, B, when we were in America, we were doing kind of like a road trip. It's like there were like it's just like there's it's a part of the infrastructure. Every gas station has a bathroom. That's how it should be. And yes, some of them do look absolutely kind of heinous.
Some of them have showers.
But also I will, yeah, I mean,
oh no, don't shower in a gas station.
Yeah, but what if you're on the run and you need to change your identity and, you know, bleach your hair and put some contacts and glasses
well,
on?
Well, I prepare for that ahead of time.
Yeah, you have your go bag. I feel I have a lot to kind of say on this issue, but, you know, we are rounding up the end of the podcast, so I'm just gonna say that if you feel me, send us an email, send us something. I want to kind of hear from people. I will just say, though, I do understand, because Australians treat their public restrooms horribly. I mean,
no, Australian men treat their public restrooms horribly.
Thank you very much for that ad, because yeah, I haven't been to the other side, but some of the things I've seen in rest stops, like where there are, like, you know, designated public toilets, are like, they are crime scenes. I mean, just absolutely horrible.
No, they're not like crime scenes. They actually are crime scenes. Yeah.
Oh my God. Speaking of that, I think we'll end from there. I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Laura Chan Baker. She's Bianca Bramham. And this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more Jackie Winter Gives You the Business, archives of all of our shows and the links we've covered can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all the links we talk about in the show each week, as well as updates to what we've done at Jackie Winter in the last week, you can sign up to our new newsletter at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, at jwg.is. biz/whoslettering. And if you want to find out more about Corvid, our new service for creative production, you can visit that at corv.id. That's corv.id. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, Apple Podcasts, you'll be able to see the links to the articles as we're talking about them. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and want to check out our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you again so much, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you next week. That's it. Bye. The brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down Shaka, the time we could dedicate each week. What is wrong?
I just had like a weird one hiccup, single hiccup. Sorry, I don't know what happened.